These are the oldest stories, online at oldeststories.net. Last time, there was a massive General Levantine revolt against Assyria. Over the course of multiple battles, all who rebelled against the world's first great empire were crushed and punished in brutal fashion. Then Assyrian attention turned towards Hezekiah of Judah, and the army marched directly southwards towards Jerusalem, smashing through fortified city after fortified city, one of which, Lachish, we have remarkably detailed information about. But as we begin today, the Assyrian army has arrived at the gates of Jerusalem. This massive army shouldn't have been a surprise to Hezekiah, and indeed it seems he had prepared for it to a certain extent. You will recall, Hezekiah inherited the throne with Judah as a tributary state of Assyria. His father Ahaz had submitted tribute in order to protect Judah from the Israelites and Aramaeans. Hezekiah, however, was strongly of the Yahwist faction, unlike his father, and he had prophets whispering in his ear, telling him not to be afraid of the Assyrians, since surely the God of the universe was way stronger than the greatest empire the world has ever yet seen. And so he spits at the Assyrian king. Once the Assyrian armies arrive, however, Hezekiah sends a messenger and says, "Hey, just kidding? Let's be friends now?" And Sennacherib of Assyria says, "Okay, we can be friends if you give me something like 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold." Hezekiah's earlier confidence in the Lord has vanished, and even though he's condemned his father for stripping wealth out of the temple, he finds himself doing the exact same thing and sending it to the Assyrian army. Sennacherib takes a look at all this wealth, and he smiles, and he tells Hezekiah that, sure enough, we are indeed friends now. However, the army is still going to come and destroy them, because that part is just business, nothing personal. Rebellion must always and everywhere be crushed, or the Assyrian Empire will be unable to support itself. Now, Sennacherib himself goes off to fight other battles, but famously leaves Rabshakeh and 2 other generals to oversee the siege of Jerusalem. Now, Rabshakeh is particularly famous for an episode where he goes up to the walls of Jerusalem and begins taunting the citizens of the city, while the captains of the Jerusalem garrison beg him to please speak in Aramaic rather than Hebrew, because all this taunting is frightening the men along the walls. And of course, Rabshakeh refuses because terrifying the people of the city is exactly the point. But the content of the speech is fascinating. Now, ancient speeches, they're always highly suspect. More than often than not, they are the products of the writer's imagination. And yet the Book of Kings has Rabshakeh mocking the people of Jerusalem for trusting in Yahweh, saying, "But if you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem'?" Now, this speech, this section of this speech, it could be a summary of something he really did say, or it could be the later writer's memory of something really critical, even if Rabshakeh himself didn't actually say it. You see, the high places that were torn down by Hezekiah were the ones that were put up, by and large, by his father Ahaz and previous generations. And they seem to have been, at least some of them, Yahwistic shrines. And the idea of worshiping exclusively in Jerusalem seems to have been seen by at least some as an innovation within this generation. And in Rabshakeh's mind, likely echoing the Judahite opposition parties, an innovation that may have turned God's face away from the nation. We see multiple chapters in the book of Chronicles all focused on Hezekiah's Jerusalemite centralization, with a discussion of how it was all unprecedented since ancient times. Of course, we do know more broadly a great deal of innovation in the ancient world we've already seen was justified by claiming that it goes back to ancient practice. And the thought that we are here seeing that very process in practice has fueled a great deal of speculation that the Holy Land prior to Israel's destruction was absolutely chock full of Yahweh shrines. And it is the sudden influx of literate prophets, combined with government support for the Yahweh faction, and catalyzed by the shock of the Assyrian invasion, that is together transforming the Yahwistic religion from some now very lost prototypical phase into the beginnings of proper Judaism. Of course, we've already seen that Yahwism is very much in evidence from an early period, some sort of worship of this particular god. And the question of how much Hezekiah is reforming versus how much he's restoring is very much an open question here among both faithful and secular scholars. Even the very accusation made by the Assyrian general could well misunderstand the peculiarities of Yahwistic religion, though if indeed this speech is being invented by the Deuteronomistic historians, then we're forced to wonder if they realized the degree to which the faith was changing in this period. Anyway, that's one speech, and probably far more terrifying than anything Rabshakeh had to say, was the massive army standing behind him while he said it. It seems that right from the start, they knew they were in for a long siege, and the Assyrian army put their engineering talent to work, constructing a ring of fortresses around Jerusalem. In standard practice, a single oval-shaped fortress camp would be constructed by a single army when arriving at their destination, building enough to fully surround Jerusalem. So we're talking at least 8, if not more, camps, would have required an army well above standard size, potentially multiple armies. We have no word if the Judahites even tried to sally out and interfere with the construction, but nothing seems to have been effective at preventing the siege itself. And then pretty quickly, Jerusalem was cut off completely from the outside world. Now, Hezekiah was prepared for this. Some of his measures in preparation had proven ineffective. For instance, his work fortifying the outlying towns hadn't been enough to keep the Assyrians out. And though he had men capping all the springs outside of town, the enemy army seems to have had enough manpower to dig them all back out so that they could have water while besieging Judah. Some of his measures, however, were far more effective. He'd constructed a mighty curtain wall around some or perhaps all of the city, which, coupled with the natural terrain of Jerusalem and the Holy Mountain, made it one of the most indomitable fortress cities in the entire region. Additionally, he'd ordered the construction of the Siloam Tunnel, an underground access way to the primary spring of the city, so that they couldn't be cut off from water. The construction of that was a pretty impressive achievement. Two teams started at either end, one within the city and one over at the Gihon Spring. And we know from their soundings that they had a good idea the entire time of where they were and how deep they were as they cut through solid rock. The idea was for the two teams to meet in the middle, and we can see archaeologically that the meeting point was actually a little bit offset, but they did pretty good for a bunch of guys boring through solid rock with hand tools. As work crews were digging beneath the ground, other workers were building a new set of fortifications called Hezekiah's Walls to protect the city, which seems to have grown during the last century of economic advancement, and perhaps from a more recent influx of religious pilgrims as well. And I say workers were doing this, but let's not forget exactly who they were. Most of the time you just see Hezekiah built all these. Of course, Hezekiah didn't build any of that. He just ordered it. The tasks would have been overseen by specialized craftsmen, stone workers on contract to the king mostly, but the actual building and digging was done by regular men. Because Israel and Judah had the same sort of tax structure as every other nation in the ancient world. Farmers would be called up for a certain number of weeks to either serve in the military or serve on public construction projects. And either way, the organization and conditions would be quite similar between military and public works. These were conscript laborers. And we can imagine, perhaps, that they were happy for the privilege of defending the holy city. But of course, there would have been plenty of discontents and dissidents as well. Citizens of Judah, who, not all of them, were that interested in Jerusalem. But they still showed up and paid their taxes, which is far more miserable when paying your taxes means heavy labor for weeks at a time. But these ranks of conscript laborers would have been supplemented with public slaves, men taken in war or purchased on the slave market with tax money, foreigner and Israelite alike, slaves toiling in the sun to build monuments and fortresses for the king, just as the Hebrews are said to have done for the Pharaoh many generations prior. And it doesn't get discussed often, but a reality of this work is that some among the men, both conscript and slave, would come out of these projects permanently crippled. And others, a small percentage but not zero, would perish in the construction. Now, for many of you this is obvious, but it's good to remember that even these good and exciting public works projects, which definitely helped the nation to survive and thrive, came with a human cost that we're nowadays largely unwilling to pay for our own nation. Anyway, all of these fortifications, plus Hezekiah pulling in as much grain as possible for the storehouses ahead of the attack, seemed to defeat the greatest siege works of the Assyrians. Remember that only a generation or so ago, Uzziah and Jotham had built catapults and ballistae on the walls of Jerusalem, which were likely capable of destroying the mighty Assyrian rams and damaging the ladders before they approached, and probably strongly discouraged any ramp building in a way that mere arrows often proved unable to. But for all that the city was proof against direct assault, the city garrison was insufficient to drive the Assyrians away, especially once they'd fortified in a ring of camps. And so Sennacherib's men waited, sending out detachments to raid villages and sack cities all around Judah, eventually taking 46 walled settlements and uncountable minor farming estates, all of which fed the army around the capital, while the army actually within the capital endured on tighter and tighter rations. This was a time of hunger and fear for the people within the walls, and a time of destruction and slavery for those outside the walls. Sennacherib claims to have taken 200,000 people out of the land of Judah. None, of course, from Jerusalem, but he had free run of the countryside for 3 years. And if that many were taken out of the land, many as well must have been simply killed, or died as an indirect consequence of the war, with all the famines and diseases and whatnot. But the walls of Jerusalem, and their associated defensive fortifications, proved strong enough that the greatest masters of siegecraft in the ancient world were either unable to take it, or unwilling to expend the lives required to take it. And so they simply held Hezekiah and the people of Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. Except more like a cage where you just don't feed the bird and don't clean out the newspapers on the bottom every so often. Outside the walls, they were sustained by the plunder of a nation and the supply chain of a mighty empire. Within the walls, they were sustained by ever tighter rations and faith. We hear about the prophet Isaiah himself urging the king and people to trust in God and promising that the siege would be lifted and that Sennacherib himself would be killed in his own lands. And then, sure enough, after 3 long years, an angel of the Lord came, which is often a biblical term for a plague. Remember the stories of King David and his plague angel. And beset the Assyrian camp, forcing them to abandon the siege. And we do think it was a plague here. Both the later historians Berossus, who was a Greek Mesopotamian, and Josephus, a Greco-Roman Jew, suggest as much. And the not always reliable Herodotus blames a bunch of mice, which could be easily associated with plague as well. And then, about 10 years later, Sennacherib was indeed killed by people within his own palace, just as Isaiah had predicted. Not right away, as far too many Bible commentaries are going to tell you. He did die like 10 years later, but sure enough, he died within his own palace, just as Isaiah had said he would. An agreement seems to have been struck during the withdrawal, reconfirming Judah as a vassal. But the city was not sacked, and no further destruction would come to the land. It's hard to underestimate how traumatic this was for the survivors of Judah. This wasn't some one-and-done thing like an earthquake or a terrorist strike. The entire world landscape has shifted. Israel has been destroyed, and Judah has spent 3 years balancing on a knife edge. And through it all, there were a handful of voices who happened to be Yahwist exclusivists who seemed to have largely managed to predict how it would all go down. Now, whether Isaiah and his buddies were just lucky, or if they were clever, or if they were divinely inspired, this seems to be the point in history where the Jews decided that it was time to have some new scripture, not just a living chain of prophets and priests acting on the older foundations of faith. And so from the time of Hezekiah to the time of Josiah, to the activities of the scribes in the Babylonian period, to the Second Temple period under Persia and then the Seleucids, the mainline faith of Judaism is going to spend quite a lot of time writing new scriptures. We have, in a way, ended the controversial section of our show. Everyone should be able to agree that Hezekiah and some religious folks around him were Yahwists, and they promoted some brand of exclusivism, either monotheism or henotheism. This means that they had some foundation of Yahwist religious tradition already in place. Maybe the first 5 books of Moses, maybe the first 4 books of Moses, or maybe a collection of traditions that would later get compiled into the Book of Moses. And everyone should agree that the vast majority of the Old Testament was shaped during the next century and a half. Some of it composed, and some of it collected from older stories. Things like the histories, these kings especially, Samuel and Kings, were clearly collected and redacted and edited during this time. Things like the prophetic writings were clearly composed at this time, or for the later prophets, of course, composed later on. Things like Proverbs and Psalms were probably a mix of the two, some individual items written earlier, but with many later additions. There's plenty of room to debate at this point what got written in what ways. And of course, the question of whether this was all the work of man or the work of God is unsettled in theory. But historically, at least, we're now pretty certain that we have a kingdom of Judah in which a large faction of people are recognizably Jewish, though of course in a way rather different than the Jews of today. Anyway, Jew or not, the city of Jerusalem is now surrounded by a destroyed nation. And we know basically nothing at all about how it was put back together. We can guess, though, that the answer is just, you know, really, really slowly and really painfully and with a lot of just absolute misery. We hear the story of Hezekiah being miraculously healed and given an extra 15 years of life, and some have suggested this is a metaphor for how Judah, as a nation, wanted to recover. The shadow going back to the steps of Ahaz could suggest that the people of Judah wish that they could go back to before all of this destruction had happened, but which, for the Yahwist faction, also meant undoing all the religious progress that they had made during the siege, which we see, indeed, in the wickedness of the next generation. One thing we do hear is that Hezekiah made provision to protect and rebuild his nation by opening up trade relations with Babylon, something roundly condemned by Isaiah. And then we hear that whatever else Hezekiah may have done is written in a book that's now lost, so of course that's the end of that. His successor was his son Manasseh, about whom scripture has surprisingly little to say compared to the volumes spoken about him in various traditions and in archaeology. Kings and Chronicles are in agreement that he was wicked. Wicked in the sense of patronizing the reconstruction of various public works projects and religious institutions that had been destroyed during the Assyrian invasion. These are, of course, Baal and Asherah shrines and probably other polytheist temples as well. He even opens up the temple in Jerusalem to multiple gods. But from the perspective of someone following the biblical narrative, we might wonder why the religious policy might shift so dramatically only 15 years after Judah had been miraculously saved through Yahwistic piety and prophetic intervention. But really, when we think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Judah, after all, hadn't actually been saved from the Assyrians. From the perspective of someone in any of the towns outside the capital, the sequence of events was roughly this. Well, first we had a pagan king and everything was fine. Then Hezekiah shows up with his radical Yahwist reforms and pressures everyone to convert, and 3 years later the Assyrians invaded. Then they destroyed literally every town outside the capital, and only left once the temple in Jerusalem had been stripped of its treasure in order to pay for Judah to return to being a subject nation. Judah was punished, and the proximate cause could easily be seen as the reformations of that generation, not the wickedness of previous generations. What's more, Hezekiah spent the back part of his reign, from archaeological indications, rebuilding primarily the area around Jerusalem. By the time Manasseh takes over, it's time to put efforts into rebuilding the rest of Judah, and it seems that the outlying areas were far more Canaanite in their worship. And so Manasseh, despite being the son of pious Hezekiah and grandson of the prophet Isaiah, found himself influenced by the interests of the wider nation, and was probably quite young at his coronation and thus likely easy to influence. And for the next 55 years, the longest reign of any Judahite king, an opponent of Yahwism is granted by God a reign marked by peace, reconstruction, and the gradual economic dominance of the South for the first time in the history of the divided monarchy. We know of wars in the region during this period, but we know of none involving Judah. And given their position as a loyal tributary, not an annexed state, it is possible, though not certain, that they didn't even have a duty to provide manpower for the various Assyrian wars against Egypt and various other regional powers. The nation is plugged into the regional trade system, and though the demographic collapse takes multiple generations to recover from, as manpower does get restored to Judah, we can see archaeologically that they take advantage of it with gusto, using their position surrounded by so many devastated neighbors to be the main trade route, just sort of by default for anyone going in that general direction. But there's little we can say about Judah's economic ascension here without noting the context. Just as the post-World War II economic boom in the USA was enabled in part by the utter destruction of the main economic competitors in Europe, so too did Judah rise by climbing up the corpses of the 10 northern tribes. It's pretty well known that the Assyrians were terrifying conquerors, and we'll see a lot of that at the end of this episode, but it's also well known that Israel was destroyed by the Assyrians. But without more context on the Assyrian Empire, it's hard to realize just how significantly Israel was destroyed. Specialists in the region agree, when looking at the destruction layers caused by the Assyrian conquests throughout the Near East, that the Assyrians destroyed Israel more completely than nearly any other place they conquered. Israel's destruction and depopulation was unusually thorough, and the repopulation by outsiders was unusually sparse. Indeed, unlike most Assyrian provinces, there is unusually sparse archaeological evidence that the Assyrians ever actually occupied the region. A handful of cities were constructed or reoccupied, and the primary evidence that Assyria was there at all, aside of course from copious written documentation in the imperial capital, is centered around a scattering of logistics outposts just in the southeast of Israel, which were essentially just a staging ground for the army whenever it needed to pass that way. The rest was emptied out, in a way that few places has ever been emptied out in human history. Like a post-apocalypse, nature took over much of the land, and we hear of a fear of wild beasts returning to the people if we look for it in the prophetic writings. Honestly, I don't know how to really describe it, except to reference the prophet Hosea, but we're going to save Hosea for the end of today's episode, so we don't get too far off track. Now, there's a wider question in all this, which is why Israel was so thoroughly destroyed and then not reoccupied. We don't have a strict answer here in history, aside, of course, from the righteous judgment of God, but it seems that unlike most places Assyria conquered, there really wasn't that much of value in the northern Samaritan and Galilean territories. The empire was pretty regularly resettling people, but it didn't resettle them just randomly. People were being sent to places of strategic significance or economic significance, and even given a fair bit of aid in those first few years to get them established as productive citizens. And so we do see settlement along the borderlands, and more sparsely along a set of major roadways. One area of concentration is just south of Tyre. One is just north of Philistine territory. One is at Megiddo, a major strategic crossroads in the area. And these three sets of developments were all clearly strategic in nature, allowing armies to be marched and staged, as well as allowing merchant convoys to be controlled when entering the nation. Then there were much smaller, economically focused settlements at Samaria and Dan, which had been among the wealthiest cities of northern Israel previously, because they'd had more economic potential than other places. But from the standpoint of the empire, this whole region was a marginal backwater, barely worth holding on to. The whole place had been destroyed not because Assyria wanted the land of Israel, but out of Assyrian pride and their reputation, out of a need to crush a rebel. Remember that in both the case of Israel and Judah, it was the Jewish kings who had initially offered submission to Assyria, and afterwards Assyria merely demanded that they keep to the agreements that they had wanted in the first place. Anyway, 55 crucial years pass in this manner, with Judah rebuilding and Israel not, and the Assyrian Empire focused on much larger things. In the midst of all this, the people of the land come up with essentially four new religious traditions, which come to lay the groundwork for all that is to come. First of all, the people who enter into Israel seem like they're generally quite polite and friendly people. Now, they're all coming from a polytheistic background, and upon arriving in the new land, courtesy, of course, of Assyrian transportation, they ask the few survivors, and they ask the folks down in Judah, who the god of the land was, so that they can properly honor him. Now, someone, it seems, tells them about the God of Abraham, and then they quite obligingly construct altars and shrines in his name. Now, of course, they establish these shrines right next to their shrines for the other gods of this land, the Baals and the Ashtoreths and such, and also right next to the gods of their former lands, which are as varied as the Iranian mountains and the Mesopotamian lowlands, the Arabian deserts, and the Anatolian foothills. That's a lot of gods, so they don't get full marks on execution here, but you know, they are trying in their way. Now, another tradition that may have existed long before, but is now really visible as a separate entity, starts to break out. Among the surviving northerners, since even the efficient Assyrians weren't able to round up literally everyone, was a group of Yahwist supremacists. Now, it isn't clear if these are monotheist exclusivists at this point, but they certainly put the god of Moses first. These guys seem to blame the destruction of their entire world on Judah, specifically saying that their faith had been corrupted ever since King Saul and the prophet Samuel. These guys cling even more strongly to a slightly modified version of the Torah, the five books of Moses. Though, of course, they'll tell you that it's the Judahites who have the modified version and they have the original. Further, they seem conversant with the stories of Joshua and the stories in the book of Samuel, though they view them both quite differently, and they have a very different idea of the kinds of things that happened during the period of the Judges. And importantly, none of these works are scripture for them. These are all merely history. These guys are going to become the Samaritans in the religious sense. I mean, geographically, they're already Samaritans, but we think of Samaritans in a geographical and religious sense, and this is that religious sense. And of course, both the Bible and later Jews are going to absolutely despise these guys, and they're going to draw absolutely no distinction between the polytheist, Yahwist inclusivists that we just discussed, and these Torah-worshipping guys, even though such a distinction seems very likely, even at a very early period. Meanwhile, mostly in the south, but possibly also in the north as well, there has been, for a while, a population of basically Canaanites, people holding to the old polytheistic religion. and while they seem to have coexisted with the Yahwists quite often, indeed they even seemed to hold him among the national deities for the most part, the increasing stridency of the Yahwist exclusivists appears to be causing ever more troubles. And I do think we're safe in blaming the Yahwists for ultimately having started these troubles. Scripture itself tells us that the early polytheists were quite happy including Yahweh in the larger pantheon. But some remarkably rude and mocking rhetoric from the prophets, as well as Yahwist-initiated pogroms during their time in power, have, it seems belatedly, invited a more consistent level of pushback, and even retaliation. King Manasseh fits this to a T, as do most of the polytheistic kings that we've seen lately. And of course, the fourth tradition is the Bible writers themselves, currently just persecuted enough to galvanize them, but not enough to wipe them out. And presently inspired by the remarkable accuracy of their shiny new scriptures in predicting the future, wondering if maybe they should try and write even more of this Bible stuff. They're politically active, that much is clear from the prophet Nahum, if nothing else, who published a bunch of anti-Assyrian invective right around this time, threatening the destruction of Judah's overlord and raining down curses upon them. Indeed, Manasseh seems to have been so opposed by the Yahwist faction that he ended up killing a bunch of them and replaced worship of Yahweh at the national temple with Canaanite deities. When he died, he even refused burial at the traditional kingly tomb, which would have ritually been closely associated with Judah's national god. Now, these four primary currents, and the biblical writer's reaction to each, is hugely important, as this is a large part of the background against which the Deuteronomic histories and many of the middle prophets are written. But this conflict also shapes Judah uniquely among nations, as other Near Eastern countries simply don't have the same level of internal religious conflict, or at least we don't hear about it. And isn't that odd, talking about, oh, most Near Eastern countries don't have any religious conflict? That's not something we have nowadays, but the past is a foreign country. And this religious conflict is ultimately going to destroy the nation. Now, since we pass super fast through the long rule of Manasseh, we now bring ourselves to within a generation of Judah's destruction. Now, at the end of Manasseh's life, before we get too far ahead, Chronicles recounts an interesting story. Apparently, for no clear reason, the Assyrian army shows up near the end of his life, and he captures the king, and then for some unclear reason brought him to Babylon to be humiliated before the Assyrian king. Now, following this experience, he then converted to Yahwist worship, he repented of his sins, he tore down pagan shrines, he restored the temple back to proper form, he brought the entire nation into proper worship, and then everyone clapped. Problem with this story, though, is that it doesn't make a lot of sense. Rabbinic traditions have even pointed out for centuries that this story feels garbled, and also ask why, if Manasseh restored the proper faith, was it necessary for Jeremiah to complain so much and for Josiah to institute reforms in the next generation? Why does the king's account omit this deathbed conversion when it seems to be a big deal? And from a more modern perspective, the mentions of Manasseh in the accounts of the Assyrian rulers of his age seem to view him as a peaceful and willing vassal, with no mention of any conflict against Judah in this period. Now, perhaps Manasseh did take a trip to visit his overlord, and perhaps he did soften on his persecution later in life, and this is merely an exaggerated or garbled account of that. Bottom line here is, we don't really know where this story comes from. We don't have a good way to fit it into the larger narrative. And the historically safest conclusion is that the chronicler, writing maybe two or three centuries later, just got something wrong, either accepting as true a wholly fake story, or misinterpreting a perhaps fragmentary mention of something that was, in reality, far less dramatic. Anyway, Manasseh dies around 643 BCE, and a good 70 years have now passed since we started today's episode with Judah under siege. Judah has slowly recovered, while Israel has largely been left desolate. And this desolation is genuinely unusual in its severity. I mentioned it before, but keep that in mind. It's weird. Whole vast swaths of the region of Samaria and the Galilee, which are, as of now, two separate regions because the Assyrians conquered and administered them separately, appear to have been completely unoccupied for a century or more. This is because it seems to have decided, the Assyrian Empire has decided, that the land just wasn't economical, compared to all the other places that the empire could invest in. Now, if we're thinking of this from Nineveh, or if we're thinking of this like a strategy video game, we can understand the logic here. But for the people actually living in Israel, or the people looking to their north from Judah, the scale of this devastation is hard to really understand. Thankfully, as I mentioned earlier, there is a contemporary writer whose writings survive, discussing, in part, the destruction of Israel. This is the book of Hosea, one of the oldest prophets, and widely agreed among both secular and faithful scholars to be genuinely from around this period. Now, the whole book of Hosea is a fascinating text. It's far too often read in a specifically Jewish or Christian context, and rarely read for being a truly ancient writing, with insights into the era and the mindset of the people at that time. But we're going to focus principally on the destruction of Israel and how it was perceived by at least the Yahwist faction in Judah. Now, Hosea was a prophet who lived both before and after the period of the destruction, and faithful readers will see his description as a heaven-sent and thus accurate image of what was about to happen, and secular readers are going to see it as a post-hoc description of the conditions on the ground. So either way, it's widely agreed to be a somewhat poetic but definitely contemporary depiction of the Assyrian destruction. Now, I'm going to jump through the book here a lot because Hosea was far more interested in harlotry than in accurate historical reporting. But we haven't read from an historical contemporary count in a long time, so I'm not going to be passing up this chance. Hosea said, "Therefore, because of sin, the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven, and even the fish of the sea are taken away. I will punish the people for their ways. They shall eat, but not be satisfied. They shall play the whore, but not multiply. A people without understanding shall come to ruin. Ephraim shall become a desolation in the day of punishment. Ephraim is oppressed, crushed in judgment, because he was determined to go after filth. But I am like a moth to Ephraim, and like dry rot to the house of Judah. When Ephraim saw his sickness, and Judah his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to the great king. But he's not able to cure you or heal your wound. For I will be like a lion to Ephraim, and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear and go away. I will carry off, and no one shall rescue. All of them are hot as an oven, and they devour their rulers. All their kings have fallen, and none of them calls upon me. Ephraim mixes himself with the peoples. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Strangers devour his strength, and he knows it not. Gray hairs are sprinkled upon him, and he knows it not. I've spurned your calf, O Samaria. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? For it is from Israel. A craftsman made it. It's not God. The calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. For they shall sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads. It shall yield no flour. If it were to yield, strangers would devour it. Israel is swallowed up. Already they are among the nations as a useless vessel. For they have gone to Assyria, a wild donkey wandering alone. Rejoice not, O Israel. Exult not like the peoples, for you have played the whore, forsaking your God. You have loved a prostitute's wages on all threshing floors. Threshing floor and wine vat shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail them. They shall not remain in the land of the Lord, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean food in Assyria. They shall not pour drink offerings of wine to the Lord, and their sacrifices shall not please him. It shall be like mourner's bread to them. All who eat of it shall be defiled, for their bread shall be for their hunger only. It shall not come to the house of the Lord. What will you do on the day of the appointed festival, and on the day of the feast of the Lord? For behold, they are going away from destruction, but Egypt shall gather them. Memphis shall bury them. Nettles shall possess their precious things of silver. Thorns shall be in their tents. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel shall know it. Ephraim's glory shall fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. Even if they bring up children, I will bereave them till none is left. Woe to them when I depart from them. Ephraim, as I have seen, was like a young palm planted in the meadow. But Ephraim must lead his children out to slaughter. Give them, O Lord, what will you give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. Even though they give birth, I will put their beloved children to death. My God will reject them because they have not listened to him. They shall be wanderers among the nations. Samaria's king shall perish like a twig on the face of the waters. The high places of Avon, the sins of Israel, shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, "Cover us," and to the hills, "Fall on us." Because you've trusted in your own way, in the multitude of your warriors. Therefore the tumult of war shall arise among your people, and all your fortresses shall be destroyed. As Shalmaneser destroyed Beth-Arbel on the day of battle, mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. But I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. You know no God but me, and beside me there is no Savior. It was I who knew you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. But when they had grazed, they became full. They were filled, and their heart was lifted up. Therefore they forgot me. So I am to them like a lion. Like a leopard I will lurk beside the way. I will fall upon them like a bear robbed of her cubs. I will tear open their breast, and there I will devour them like a lion, as a wild beast would rip them open. Though Samaria may flourish among his brothers, the east wind, the wind of the Lord, shall come, rising from the wilderness, and his fountain shall dry up, his spring shall be parched, it shall strip his treasury of every precious thing. Samaria shall bear her guilt, because she has rebelled against her God. They shall fall by the sword, their little ones shall be dashed in pieces, and their pregnant women ripped open. And as the prophet spoke, through the voice of God, these very things appear to have happened during the devastation of Israel. Now, according to the prevailing thinking of the times, all these bad things had come from God, and they were all the fault of the victims. Nowadays, we're very worried about victim blaming, but the Bible's not so worried about all that, when it looks to God more like justice. Anyway, we're probably going to get into those sort of theological implications in a special episode pretty soon about biblical morality, squaring it with modern notions of the same. But before that, we need to destroy Jerusalem, which is exactly what's going to happen in the next episode. So join us next time for the reforms of Josiah, the Battle of Armageddon, and the destruction of Judah at the hands of God's agents. Thank you for listening.